There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman-Ellen, and I'm your host. On today's program, the FCC plucks two new principles from the divinity of network neutrality. As well, they say thumbs up to low-power FM. We're going to get to this and lots of other things that are going on in our communications environment with my pal John Anderson of DIYmedia.net. Do stay tuned. John, thanks for joining me.
It's been a long time. I'm glad to be back.
No,
and you're live
here in the studio, on the phone, not on Skype.
I'm not in Champaign. I'm really happy about that.
Here
right
in the
now.
Beautiful Evanston studios at WNUR-FM. Very, very glad to be here. It's a fantastic station. You come on because you are a media researcher. You're finishing up your PhD,
mm-hmm.
Institute of Communications Research, writing your dissertation on digital radio, specifically known as HD radio in the U.S. or IBOC, in-band on channel
and
radio.
And actually, I am adding a chapter about global digital radio.
Okay, great. So we may get to that a little later. It's a topic we like to get to here. One of the areas you love to research, at least on your own, is pirate radio, unlicensed radio.
Yeah.
But you generally keep your eyes on it. So, but you pay attention to what's going on, and you often have pretty trenchant observations.
As much as one person can, yeah.
But we would be remiss on this program altogether if we didn't cover a couple of pieces of news that have happened in the last couple of weeks. The first of which is this Monday, the FCC chairman, Julius Genachowski, went and spoke at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. to advocate on behalf of the preservation of a free and open internet.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet, and up to now, at least in the most recent history, the FCC has had what they call four principles.
Right.
On internet. I don't know what they could, four principles on, they just call them four open internet principles, is
right.
What they call them. Which sort of get around, something that are generally called net neutrality, the idea that your internet service provider should be neutral with regard to what you do on the internet, provided it's legal.
What makes the internet a wonderful communications medium is that the intelligence of the network is on the edges. It is not located in a centralized area, and that people that provide internet access are supposed to be, at least in a in a utopian world, would be common carriers. They have lines, you have data, you use their lines to transmit the data. That's the service that's provided. But because there is artificial scarcity in the amount of bandwidth available to users of the internet, telecommunications companies have started to practice things what they call network management, which is a benign way of sometimes discriminating against certain types of content or applications or things like that. And the FCC, for the longest time, kind of danced around the issue. Network neutrality has been around as a telecommunications policy issue in D.C. since about 2005. I remember writing one of the first stories on it for Media Minutes, and I called it data discrimination back in the day. And the FCC came out with these kind of four milquetoast principles of what an open internet should be. And Genachowski is now actually taking that a couple of steps further, which is a nice sign. But what did he actually do?
The first four, so we have sort of the groundwork here, is that the principles say that consumers must be able to access the lawful internet content, lawful internet applications, services of their choice, and attach non-harmful devices to the network. And these really do kind of map onto the common carrier rules for,
from
say, telephones.
Telephone networks, yeah.
In the speech on Monday, the 21st, Jenikowski added two. The first would prevent internet access providers from discriminating against particular internet content or applications while allowing for reasonable network management. And that's, those are all hedge words. Words like whenever you hear reasonable, that's a hedge word.
Right. And the fact that it comes immediately after saying we will not allow discrimination, mm-hmm. so long as the way you discriminate is transparent, is the way that a lot of internet service providers, I think, are probably going to read something like that. And of course,
second principle is would ensure that the internet access providers are transparent about the network management practices they implement.
So we can still discriminate against data if we provide a logical rationale for doing so.
I think it's difficult to really parse that sentence, because on one argument, let's say assume that Jenikowski is attempting to truly reflect the spirit of network neutrality here, we can say that sentence tries to mean that we don't want to tell ISPs that they can't limit bandwidth at certain times of day, for instance.
Right.
Right. And over the day part, often usage goes up, like, you know, in the early evening when people get home from work, or it's high on certain parts on a Saturday, and that they might not be able to say, whoa, you can't, you know, download, 2000 gigabits on a 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock on a Monday. Allow them to do that, but saying that, but they cannot discriminate, meaning they can't tell you, oh, you can, you know, download content from our business partner, but you may not download content from YouTube. But it's not entirely clear that is fully fully there in that statement.
Yeah, and you know, I think to play devil's advocate to that idea, and to really show the wonkish side of me is, In certain ways, when you're talking about digital distribution of information, especially over the network of networks that we call the internet, bandwidth is content. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you don't have bandwidth, you can't have content. So even by restricting bandwidth usage because of network management rationales, inherently, you are restricting access to content. Whether or not you're doing it for content-specific reasons or not, you're doing it because you have a limited infrastructure that you have oversold and underinvested in. And until the FCC is actually willing to put some teeth behind these principles and start saying, mm-hmm. no, one of the ways we could actually solve this problem, and it's been something the FCC's kicked around for a while, is there's this fund that was set up for a phone service called the Universal Service Fund. And it was a government, basically a surcharge, which is still on people's phone bills, including cell phone bills. And the money goes into a pot, and that money is supposed to be used to build out telephone infrastructure to places where it would normally be economically infeasible to do that. So rural areas or the poor communities or things like that where there isn't a lot of money going on. At least that way there would be some sort of government incentive or subsidy to provide that. If we applied the money from the Universal Service Fund to internet service provision,
right,
we would, you know, open up a whole pot of money that might be able to spur the dominant telecommunications service providers to actually invest in the network. Mm-hmm. And that's where the rubber really meets the road, is the bandwidth is there in certain parts of the network. The backbone is not overwhelmed.
Right.
It's the last mile connections.
It's been the build-out, which has been promised now going back to the mid-90s.
Right.
When the local ISPs, most of which have been absorbed into the larger mega telecommunications companies, went to their local state legislatures and said, hey, if you deregulate, we'll build out. You'll have 100 megabits by the year 2000. And it's 2009, and we have, some of us have 15.
Well, I got 10 on a good day.
That's about what I get. 10, you know, 10 on a
good
day.
But
so a couple of things in this speech here I want to get back to. One thing that the chairman did, Chairman Jenikowski, is he says that he proposes clarifying that all these principles apply to all platforms that access the internet. That would include wireless. That would include cellular. That could include, you know, your data plan. And you know, I think increasingly that becomes very important since more people are now accessing the internet every day on a wire, using a wireless device, especially populations, people who are, you know, less economically well off, who are not inclined to buy computers at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in not buying computers, not going to have local home internet service, but who can still would still be accessing content via their mobile devices. And I think it's important that that get applied. Jenikowski says he'll seek to begin the process of codifying the commission's existing four open internet principles, along with the two additional principles, through a notice of proposed rulemaking. So I think that sounds like what he's trying to do is to, in a way,
open a discussion, reopen the discussion on the issue,
and move towards something that might stand a little stronger as policy. Since, well, the FCC opened this door to begin with by declassifying internet as a common carrier service to which these openness principles already apply.
We can thank the Supreme Court for that one. Yeah, and the FCC ruled, was advocating for separating internet access from telephone access.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is maybe a step back in that direction towards at least giving it some greater teeth. Not to say that that won't open up another door for a court challenge, which currently Comcast is pursuing against the FCC when they slapped Comcast's wrists for interfering with BitTorrent traffic.
Well, you know, there's two things that I kind of have to say in response to that. The first one is that, okay, if we apply the principles of open internet or network neutrality to wireless networks, that's all fine and dandy and good. But one of the problems is similar to wired networks, is the infrastructure has been underinvested in. Everyone's got iPhones now.
As an iPhone user, I can advocate. I can say that
your AT&T service is a turtle. You know,
not enough,
and it's because AT&T either under anticipated or simply just wasn't smart enough to recognize the demand that iPhone usage would put on its network. Now, if the FCC passes a rule saying you can't discriminate against people that are using an iPhone for a certain reason to do something, that's fine. But that still leaves AT&T in a position to say, well, you still can't use those services during peak times because we don't have enough sticks up and there's enough bandwidth. The other thing that I think is really going to have to solve this problem is a legislative solution. The FCC is a regulatory body which takes its direction from Congress. And everything that the FCC does, and one of the reasons why the FCC finds itself in court so much, is because they will interpret statutes in ways that create new regulations. And that is what they've started to do with this first four open internet principles that were elucidated, you know, during the Kevin Martin years. The FCC. And what we need is legislation that tells the FCC, you must do this, and these are the explicit rules to follow. And there's actually a piece of legislation that's pending in Congress right now called the Internet Freedom Preservation Act. It's been a bill that's gone through several sessions of Congress and has not made it to a floor vote as of yet. And maybe having signals from the FCC that they would be open to this might push Congress in the direction of actually passing this bill, which would then give the FCC all the leverage they need to stand on this. The other interesting thing is the day after Jenikowski gave that speech, I don't remember who it was, but it was a Republican member of the Senate, essentially introduced a bill to effectively repeal what Jenikowski wants to do. So there's all, you know, this fight is not over. It's not going to be over anytime soon. It's nice to see the FCC chairman taking a stance and expanding the idea of open access to all data platforms. But it's going to take real laws passed by real legislative bodies to mandate the FCC to make what the FCC decides stick. And I don't think we're going to see an Internet Freedom Preservation Act come out of Congress this year.
Not the way things are going. It doesn't seem as though anything having to do with telecommunications policy of any sort is very high on their list at the moment.
Except for broadband. And that's not really an FCC function. That's something that's happening at the National Telecommunications and Information Administration.
Yep. I'm trying to look up the Internet Freedom and Preservation Act to see where it stands. It's been referred to the House Committee on Energy and Commerce.
Wonderful. Now, if they'll just mark up the bill and we can get it to a floor vote, we'd be getting somewhere.
And there are four co-sponsors.
All right. We have momentum. Is that in the House? Four co-sponsors?
That is in the House. Currently, Representative Eshoo from California, Representative Seestack, Pennsylvania, Waxman of California, and Woolsey of California. That is the current status of that bill in the House. I will look up the Senate version of the bill.
I think there was a bipartisan co-sponsorship in the Senate.
Yeah, that sounds
Olympia
right to me.
Snow and somebody else. I can't remember.
Yeah, well, I'm not finding the Senate version. So online, as we go, research isn't turning much up. But I think I agree with you completely on that. The FCC can only do so much. The FCC can make things a little uncomfortable, but they will find that it'll be very difficult to act on their own.
One of the things that's been so frustrating about this specific issue is that it's really not that complicated.
No.
But because there's so much at stake, and especially when we're talking about infrastructure investment at stake, opponents to the idea of internet freedom or network neutrality have done all they can to muddy the issue in a way that would actually make a person that would otherwise have common sense think twice about this. A great example of this is the Communication Workers of America. I think you had one of the representatives on your show.
Indeed, I did.
And you specifically asked them a question back in 2006 when the Internet Freedom Preservation Act had first begun circulating in the House and Senate. The CWA sided with Verizon and AT&T and Comcast and companies like that because Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast told them, if we have to spend all this money on infrastructure, we're going to have to cut jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the union went, oh, crap, we can't do that. We can't cut jobs. So we're gonna oppose anything that might cause our constituency harm. When in actuality, by mandating telecommunication service providers to expand their infrastructure, you have to hire more people to string fiber optic cables and things like that. And it's just such a no-brainer. I mean, we're supposedly one of the superpowers in the world, yet we rank, 24th?
Something like 15th, I think, at least the last time I looked.
You know, by the OECD rankings in broadband penetration or by dollars per or megabits per dollar that we get. Mm-hmm. We pay one of the highest rates for the lowest amount of internet access and connectivity in the entire world. And that's just wrong. It doesn't make any sense. But it really just comes down to dollars and cents. And so I'm really happy that Julius Genachowski is coming out and saying these things. He's
it's definitely
up
better
worms.
Than what we heard out of from Kevin Martin, who tried to dodge and weave on the issue.
But let's hope this just doesn't turn into another big rhetorical fisticuff.
Well, I'm sure it will. I'm sure we can bet it will.
That's why policy wonks stay employed.
Exactly. And you are listening to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm Parmeet Manil, and I'm your host. And with me today is John Anderson of DIYmedia.net, helping me go over some of the big pressing issues in media policy.
Doing the best I can.
Today, what's going on in our media environment. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. The radio show is at Radio.MediaGeek.net. Twitter feed, you can tweet back if you like. Or find out all sorts of little goings on. Twitter.com/MediaGeek. If you've got comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@MediaGeek.net. And if you want to call in and join the conversation, anything we
That's
say.
That's right, we have phones here.
We have phones here. If anything we say gets you steaming, or you agree, or you want to talk about some other issue having to do with radio,
or
internet, or policy.
Or if you just want to say, what are you talking about? Could you try to put that in plain English for us?
Exactly.
We'll try. I mean, we're communications people. That's why we do the show.
Give us a call, 847-866-WNUR, 847-866-9687. That's the number you can call to join the conversation. Well, the other thing, the FCC, and this was an interesting in that it was a unanimous statement of all commissioners while in front of the House Commerce Subcommittee hearing on a bill that would restore low power FM. All the commissioners said, yes, we support.
We would support an expansion of low power FM.
You know, and his backstory, low power FM is a service which we don't really have here in Chicago, but is elsewhere in more rural parts of Illinois, where you can get a low wattage station, 100 watt station.
Or less,
though they've really not been licensed yet. But in principle, they could get a 10 watt station. Must be non-commercial, must be locally owned and locally based, owned by an established community group as well, specifically to provide community radio service at a very low cost, since a 100-watt transmitter is relatively inexpensive. All the facilities are inexpensive. And on top of that, the licensing procedure had a much reduced engineering and paperwork element to it.
The application itself was free.
So the application was much easier to do, whereas a typical full-power station application requires expensive engineering surveys on all sides, and of course now for the commercial band is part of an auction.
Right.
Got created in 2000 by the FCC, too much applause by public interest advocates, too much derision by the commercial radio industry
and National Public Radio.
And National Public Radio, who succeeded in having the service cut off at its knees late that year during backroom budget negotiations. Which they were able to have inserted into a omnibus bill, a provision which would limit low-power FM to having to obey the same spacing requirements as full-power stations, thereby cutting off much of the potential of low-power FM, since one of the real innovations of the service was going to be that it would open up additional channels of service, especially in crowded metropolitan areas like Chicago, New York, LA, and on and on.
Right.
And so pretty much every year since then.
Every year since then,
right. A bill has been floated in Congress.
Right, and its name keeps changing. This year it's called the Local Community Radio Act.
Restore low power FM
to its original technical parameters.
Undo it. Yes, right. Exactly. And committee hearing had, and indeed, this bill has many more sponsors than the Internet Freedom Preservation
80
Act.
80 in the House and 7 in the Senate.
Now 81.
We picked up one since Monday.
I found this is interesting. Ron Paul is a sponsor. He's a co-sponsor of this.
Well, you know, he's not. Never mind.
You can see this is a libertarian issue.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a partisan issue by any stretch of the imagination.
It's not particularly partisan.
It's an issue of access to media, and the reason why the service was restricted in the first place was because these established incumbents effectively bamboozled Congress with fake science, with junk science.
They
blinded them with junk science and got them to pass this bill, which technically restricted the proliferation of low-power FM stations. So since 2001, the FCC opened a total of 25 days of application windows, 5 windows for 5 days apiece for the entire country, which has resulted in approximately 800 to 1,000 low-power FM stations being on the air today, which is a pretty significant number considering that we didn't have any before, unless you were breaking the law and doing it pirate style. Or you were grandfathered in as the old school low power FM radio stations.
Such as
no
the station at IIT, the Illinois Institute of Technology in the south end of Chicago.
Right. And so basically we have spent the last 9 years trying to disprove something that was a lie to begin with. Mm-hmm. And finally, and in fact, when Congress originally eviscerated low power FM, they commissioned a report to confirm or deny the incumbents' claims that low power FM stations would cause oceans of interference to full power FM stations. And that report came out, and the FCC originally didn't release it until they were hit up with a Freedom of Information Act request and threatened to be sued. And the report basically justifies the expansion of low power FM. And it's been sitting in the FCC's circular file ever since, because the FCC can't do anything until Congress changes the law. So at this oversight hearing, I can't remember who the congressman was that asked the question, but he asked each specific commissioner, do you support an expansion of this?
And it was Mike Doyle, a Democrat of Pennsylvania.
Who's, I think, one of the original sponsors of the Local Community Radio Act. And each one emphatically said yes. you know, without qualifications, they all said yes. And so he responded with, well, then I don't think we'll have any problem passing this legislation through Congress this year and the FCC. And the FCC, I think, would like to do it. If you talk to the people in the audio division of the Media Bureau, they love this kind of thing. You know, what we forget about is that politicians and elected officials and appointed officials may actually make a lot of the policy, but the people who implement the policy are career civil servants. And a lot of those people get into the positions that they get into because they actually believe in what they want to do. Many people that work for the FCC and work in the audio division don't want to keep your average Joe off the air. They would love to see more radio stations on the air. And so people like, for example, Peter Doyle, who's been one of the point people in the audio division of the Media Bureau, is, you know, praying for this thing to pass. But because he's a member, he's an employee of the FCC, he can't lobby Congress. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this is going to come down to whether or not Congress gets off its collective keister and actually passes this.
And people have been thinking, I mean, you know, those who are fans of Low Power FM have been really thinking this. Is the proper Congress for this to happen in? As you mentioned, it is sort of a bipartisan issue, and the NAB has been able to buy off, you know, the Democrats as well as the Republicans. It was President Clinton who signed the omnibus bill and authorized the backroom deal, which traded away Low Power FM for something else. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, Democrats have been friendlier to the bill than Republicans. And even, you know, obviously Republicans like Ron Paul or Olympia Snow or John McCain has been a big friend of Low Power FM pretty much since the beginning. And has been a primary or co-sponsor of the bills, pretty much each one that's gone to the Senate. So people have thought that there really is probably the better chance this year than there ever has been before. But there is really that sense of getting off the collective keister.
Well, you know, it's one of these things where you have to look at the legislative process and break it down into its constituent parts. First, the bill has to be introduced. Then it has to be referred to a committee. Then it has to be what's called marked up, which is voted out of committee onto the floor. Then it has to be scheduled for a vote on the floor. Then it has to be approved on the floor by a vote of the committee as a whole, which would be either the House or the Senate. And if there's differences between the two bills, then they meet in conference committee to work out what the final law is that then goes to the president, who then either signs it or vetoes it or lets it sit on his desk for 10 days, at which point it becomes law. And every time we make one of these steps forward, it's portrayed as some sort of monumental occasion. Okay, woo! The first time we passed this bill, we got it introduced.
Right.
Isn't that a great accomplishment? No, because it didn't result in anything functional. Okay, now the bill's in committee. Woo, isn't that great? No, because the bill has still got to get to the floor to get voted on. So let's start celebrating when the bill is actually scheduled for a vote in both houses of Congress, all right? Then I'm going to start making my phone calls to my representatives. By the way, my representative is a Republican from East Central Illinois who is a sponsor.
And we have many sponsors from Chicago, say Jesse Jackson Jr. Bobby Rush is not a co-sponsor. Never has been either. Although Representative Schakowsky, Jan Schakowsky, who represents my district, which spans north side of Chicago and Evanston. She is a co-sponsor here, along with 69 others. Mm-hmm. So at least, you know, I'm not sure if every state is represented or not. But yes, it's a long way to go. And, you know, the House Commerce Committee has to get off its keister. And
then the entire Congress has to get off its keister, and then President Obama
has to
get off his keister.
And this is how it dies on the vine.
And then, once the bill is passed, giving the FCC the power to actually do something, then the FCC has to get off its keister and write the new rules to expand the service.
John?
Paul?
Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I hope to be back sometime before the end of the year.
John Anderson of DIYmedia.net. MediaGeek is online, MediaGeek.net. Send me comments, Paul, at MediaGeek.net. Twitter.com/MediaGeek. They got it all out now.
All right, and check DIYmedia.net. I'll be updating the enforcement action database and keeping the FCC on their toes.